Are we a little done with, I know this is, you're going to hate me for this. Robert De Niro, a little old, right?
What are you talking about? The guy's still, are you kidding? No, not a little, he just had his birthday. He just turned 78 years old.
I mean, he's had such a career. It's enough. It's enough with Robert De Niro.
No, no, no. That's like people who want Federer to retire. Like, as long as you still got it, why not? Like, listen, Cody, if you don't want to watch it, what do you care? You don't have to watch his movies. If you've had enough, it's enough
he's
for you. You can just
it
go
as
move
an
on.
Actor.
The Irishman was one of his best films. That's a 3 hour and a half movie, and he's in virtually every scene of the movie. Like, it was incredible, his performance. I would completely agree with you. He has made some bad movies the last decade. No question. He's had some stinkers. Dirty Grandpa, obviously, notably, you know, Rocky and Bullwinkle. Has he mailed it in? 100%. But is he still capable of greatness? Yes. And Killers of the Flower Moon will be part of that. And The Irishman was that. Silver Linings Playbook, great film, 2011.
I'm doing my Robert De Niro right now impression, just my face. Like, it doesn't sound like him, but do the face.
I wish people could see Chris's face right now.
Robert De Niro, that's the face.
Filled with endearing, empathetic performances, Coda tells a fairly conventional coming-of-age story that is no less charming for being familiar. That's from Audrey Fox of We Live Entertainment. That is our featured review this week here, Coda. If you noticed last week, though, we're doing something a little bit different as far as the way our reviews are coming to you, because honestly, here in Cinephile, we give you a little bit of everything, okay? We give you something new, we give you something old, and then we have a wild card. So the new
love
is,
a wild
yes.
card. Love a wild card.
The wild card is kind of what makes things really interesting, right, Cody? Because that's unpredictability. That's what we thrive on here on Cinephile. So Apple Plus is a new film called Coda, unlike the film that you thought it was, right, Chris? What was the other Coda you were thinking of?
Listen, man, I'm just trying to keep up around here. You said we're talking about a film named Coda. I looked up Coda. First thing that popped up is some 1987 Australian made-for-TV horror film. Okay? I'm like, Adnan is getting wacky with these reviews now. I'm like, this will definitely be the wild card. But no, apparently it's our new, and there's a new one coming out. What is it, on Apple Plus?
It is on Apple Plus right now. So it was a huge hit at the Sundance Film Festival. It won the Grand Jury Prize, which is the equivalent of winning Best Picture. Apple Plus paid $25 million for it, which is record-breaking to have the film. So yeah. Go get your streamers. Check out Apple Plus. As far as the old, so yes, classic films. Because you're now listening to this as Labor Day approaches and summer is officially over, what I lament is the great comedies of the past. Normally every summer you'd say, have you seen this comedy? And we don't have that anymore. This year you say, hey, Stillwater was a brilliant award-beating film. In the Heights, I think, was an excellent musical. You got your kids' movies with Jungle Cruise and Paw Patrol. Where's that great comedy that all of us can go together and watch two times, three times, four times? Doesn't exist. So we're going to go back in the time capsule and two great August comedies that I think of every time. There's Something About Mary, which actually opened in July, but it hit number one in August. It took a few weeks, and the movie really had legs, to use studio movie parlance. And then Superbad, another great August comedy. I could throw in Sausage Party, which I watched at the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, but I'm going to exclude that one. But those are some great August comedies. Like, you think August comedies, Chris, those ones come to mind.
Superbad's one of my favorite movies ever. Like, when I think of just good, rated R comedy, so many memorable lines. Oh, I love it. One of my favorites ever.
And then our wild card. So we got something new, something old, and we got a wild card every episode here on Cinephile. The 86 Mets. That's right. Nick Davis is the director, and it's coming. It's a new 30 for 30 on ESPN Films. It is excellent. Four parts, 3 hours and 20 minutes. I crushed 200 minutes on the 86 Mets, so can't wait to talk to Nick about that. If you're looking for stars and you want star power when it comes to movies, you know, you check out Awards Chatter, my buddy Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter. You check out Mark Maron, WTF. But if you want a podcast with authors, Cinephile is the place for you. Cinephile 3.0. We are 3 months in. This is our sixth author, okay? Nick Davis, in addition to being a director, is also an author. His new book is called Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, A Dual Portrait. And yes, there will be some salacious material in there. How about that? Cody, the next time somebody tries to typecast me and go, oh, I know you don't read, you're just a movie guy. No, I've just cranked out six books, okay? I'm reading 25 books a year here. Like, I'm as a prolific a rate of anyone you know as far as reading books.
You read way too much, if I can just frankly say it. But one of my favorite things about producing for you in this few months that I've been doing it is you like to work blue. I didn't see it coming, no pun intended. And Adnan Virk, you I was going to make another inappropriate joke. Let's just say.
Come on, Cody.
I'm enjoying The Working Blue with Adnan Virk. Maybe that should be the name of the podcast.
I love, there was a great tweet we got. Somebody said that early on, Dan referred to Adnan, I think it was on the South Beach Sessions, as fundamentally decent. And then you listen to this podcast, every single time Virk has a chance to be fundamentally indecent, he is taking that opening. Trust me, it's going to be entertaining what's coming up. Let's start off with Coda. So Coda is one of those movies, Chris, you say to yourself, oh man, it's the kind of movie David Sampson's going to love, which is to say somebody who thinks they know movies is going to love it. And it's got rave reviews everywhere. And I'm here to tell you, stop. Please just stop, okay? Just because a movie is well-meaning and has its heart in the right place and is something different doesn't mean it's not following the same old formula. And ultimately, it's a disappointment. Yeah, I said it, okay? Here's what is good about the film. CODA stands for Children of Deaf Adults. And you rarely see a lot of films about deaf people. Sound of Metal, which was my number one film of last year, the great Riz Ahmed was incredible in the film, should have won the Oscar, was nominated for Best Actor, lost to Anthony Hopkins for The Father, another great film though. He gave a rare performance. That is obviously an actor who is hearing playing a deaf actor. CODA is amazing for the fact that it actually has deaf adults in the major roles. This is why it was a perfect as a Sundance movie. The Sundance Film Festival is all about independent films, and Robert Redford has championed these movies, and Troy Kotsur plays the dad, is actually a deaf working actor, apparently does a great job on Broadway. Leo, Daniel Durant, also a deaf actor. Marley Matlin, you know her name, right? She won an Academy Award, Children of a Lesser God, way back in 1986. She is also in the film playing the mom. Now, there's one character who can hear. That's Ruby Rossi, the young woman. That's Amelia Jones. So how about this concept? You have got deaf parents, a deaf brother, and then the one kid can hear. It's based loosely on the 2014 French film La Famille Bélier. And honestly, it's an interesting concept. Just imagine if Chris Cody could hear and your parents were deaf. Imagine if I could hear my parents were deaf. Interesting concept, right? But ultimately, the movie is so force-fed and ends up being so sentimental. Let me tell you the story, and you're going to say to yourself, I've heard this story a billion times. It's about a kid who wants to break free of her family. Her family, because of poor economic means, expects her to be a part of their community. They have a fishing boat. It's not doing particularly well. She's critical because on the boat, they can't hear when there's rival boats or rival signals and such. So the fact that she can speak sign language, she's fluent, it's so critical to them. But she wants to break free. She has a dream. She's a singer. By the way, how predictable is that? So Children of a Deaf Adult, what's her pure gift? It's singing. Oh, so her great musical gift is something the parents can never fully appreciate, which gives us one of the most cliched scenes ever. You know there's a finale coming where she's going to give a big show-stopping sequence and the parents can't hear a thing. So the way that they're recognizing how good their daughter is by looking around the rest of the crowd. That scene is actually unique because at one point the director mutes the volume and you're seeing it through the dad's eyes. So he's looking around just watching the parents. Oh, they seem to be liking it. They seem to be emotional. Okay, I think my daughter's crushing it. Where the movie jumps way over the shark is later on he asks her through sign language, hey, do the song for me. And she starts singing it and he's saying through sign language louder. And I'm like, you can't hear a thing. This is a preposterous scene. It's so ridiculous. So listen, it's one of those movies, again, it has its heart in the right place. I wish we saw more movies about deaf adults. Absolutely. I wish that there's more films about the hearing impaired community. The fact that Apple Plus paid $25 million, okay, great. Maybe we'll see more films like this. But can we see more films about these people that are not as gooey and as sentimental and as predictable? It's following a very familiar playbook, and I got to be honest with you, considering the hype, I thought the noise was not as deafening as I was expecting. I'm giving this two Maple Leafs for CODA.
Coming of age tale, right? I mean, I feel like it's one of those things. It's like, how many of these do we need? I mean, the deaf aspect, though, that is interesting. Like,
right. That's the wrinkle to it. You go, okay, I haven't seen this before. This is interesting. But girl trying to break through from family, aspires to be a singer, doesn't have the economic means. Maybe she'll get a scholarship. Oh, she has to crush it at this prestigious Juilliard type school. And then the big finale. Oh, here's the big song coming. And will she leave her family to follow her dreams? Will she? Will she, Lassie? Will she follow her dreams? I'm like, come on. I'm amazed at the amount of people who are like, this is one of the best films of the year. If this is one of the best films of the year, we're in trouble. Okay, this is a bad year for movies then.
What if this is, Anan? Is this a good year so far for movies? How would you assess this
no,
year?
No, it's been
movies?
A bad. I just told you, there's been two great movies, Stillwater and In the Heights. That's it. We're into September, for God's sakes. All the great movies are going to come in the last. Think about that. 8 months, two good movies. We're running at a ratio of one great film for every 4 months. So, God, September, October, November, December. Give us James Bond. Give us Dune. Give us all these other films that are coming out because we're definitely in trouble when it comes to movies. By the way, there's one. How about this from the stock character? You're going to have a ethnic guy who plays the teacher, Mr. Villalobos, played by Eugenio Derbez, a triple threat superstar in Mexico. He ups the wattage of the... You know, he's got to be quirky, right? Can't just be a normal music teacher. He's going to be this Mexican guy, kind of weird. He's talking about his latte with a special kind of nut milk. I mean, it was...
I do like almond milk.
Could you imagine someone listening? Because you know what? I wasn't going to watch Coda, but the mention of the milk, the fact that Cody mentioned there's almond milk, maybe I'm going to like this. You know,
put you over the
underdog
edge.
Story, David versus Goliath. I will tell you a couple things were interesting, though. Dad is very crusty. He's also flatulent. Like at one point, he says, "Do you know why farts smell so bad?" He's like, "Because, you know, God wants even deaf people to smell them." I'm like, it's unbelievable. The guy's just dropping farts everywhere. Also very horny. Like at one point, there's a scene where the daughter goes in like, oh my God, her would-be boyfriend catches her parents copulating. And she's like, oh my. And the dad's like, listen, through sign language again, he's saying, do you blame me? Look how hot your mom is. What do you expect me to do?
A horny dad that farts a lot.
Yeah, don't be surprised if he gets Academy Award recognition just for those things. Horny dad that farts a lot, but he's just trying to listen to Ruby, you know, the blue-collar patriarch.
I'm in here. I'm actually doing this right now, like, and another producer from Levitard Show, Winningham, is just kind of like not listening to you, but only can hear the random things I'm saying, and his head went up when I was like, a horny dad who farts.
What is happening?
Now listen, Witty is great. Witty sent us a very random tweet saying, I love the job
yes,
the Cinephile is doing, so that is very class work there from Chris Winningham. Make sure you tell him I said thank you. He's a good man. By the way, another great tweet we had. Somebody summarized last week's episode, and all they wrote was, Muhammad Ali, wiretaps, Polish impotence. Can I just say I love this audience?
Adnan, I got a good news story. I found a good news story that I like here. Martin Scorsese's getting a little taste of his own medicine. All right, his daughter. Now, back when he was promoting The Irishman in 2019, apparently, what did he say? He said Marvel movies are not cinema.
That's correct. He equated them to theme parks. I loved his comments.
And now...
He absolutely buried the fact there's way too many crappy Marvel movies. I loved it.
The funny thing is he's not entirely wrong, but his daughter...
Correct.
His daughter, yeah. Obviously a young woman... came after him, of all places, on TikTok. Now, I'm pretty sure that there's no way Martin Scorsese is on TikTok. So I would imagine there's a chance he hasn't even seen this. You know, the news is popping up, and he's, you know, his people are like, hey, your daughter's talking shit about you. And that's, I'm sure, how he learned of this, right? There's no way Martin Scorsese's on TikTok.
No, she's not. I've definitely seen her Instagram, which I follow, just to see him. So she pops up a lot of pictures of him, and I think I follow his Instagram, which is, again, she's clearly doing it. Like, she just takes a picture of her dad on a boat at some random thing. But TikTok, there's no way.
I respect someone who doesn't let their dad just say whatever they want. You call your dad out when they say ridiculous things. These old people, you know, maybe this is just me with my biases and my dad. People often say that I'm mean to my dad. No.
Sure.
If who's going to check these people if their kids aren't? That's what kids are meant to do. Check your parents. Martin Scorsese said something, even though it's true, it's a little dismissive. So his daughter, okay. Young, Gen Z, I don't even know what she is. She set him straight, and I like it.
Yeah, what she did was, she had a video, and the on-screen text was, my dad, marvelous cinema. She's lip-syncing to Rihanna's demo of a Selena Gomez song, Same Old Love. The lyrics coincide perfectly with the whole ordeal. Take away your things and go. You can't take back what you said. I know. I've heard it all before at least a million times. Now, Francesca loves her dad. She's always posting with her dad. She says so people are like intimidated by him. She's like, listen, he's just a sweet old man. He's not intimidating at all, even though his films.
Good job, Francesca.
Right? But I think it's brutal that she did that. Like, I got to be completely honest. I couldn't disagree with you more. First of all, his comments were right. I mean, he said Marvel is not cinema. He's right. In his categorization of cinema, it is storytelling and something bold and genuine and unique. And this is like theme parks, which it sounds dismissive. And I get what you're saying. It definitely was condescending. I'll give you that. But he's right. Like, it's just mass market produced movies. It does not, at least in his mind, does not equate to cinema. Is that true? Like, at least in his mind,
I just love the idea of him responding on TikTok, making a TikTok dance. Martin Scorsese, some dance that just sends a message to his daughter. I don't know. I just love the idea. Any story that has Martin Scorsese and TikTok in it, I'm going to read that story.
I'm with you on that. And the fact that he's currently working on Killers of the Flower Moon, hard at work, two of his most frequent collaborators, Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio. And before he gets to shooting this epic film, oh, wait, Marty, yeah, Francesca's got something for you. What's that? Did she call me? No, it's on TikTok. Yeah. Do you want to... No, I'll get to
it
later.
I need you to respond on TikTok later. Okay, Marty.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll get to that in a second. Just action. Okay.
Are we a little done with... I know this is good. You're going to hate me for this. Robert De Niro. A little old, right?
What are you talking about? The guy's still... Are you kidding? No, not a little... He just had his birthday. He just turned 78 years old.
I mean, he's had such a career. It's enough. It's enough with Robert De Niro.
No. That's like people who want Federer to retire. Like, as long as you still got it, Why not? Like, listen, Cody, if you don't want to watch it, what do you care? You don't have to watch his movies. If you've had enough, it's enough
he's
for
still
you.
Crushing
you can just
it
go
as
move
an actor.
On.
He's still crushing it.
Yeah. The Irishman was one of his best films. That's a 3 hour and a half movie, and he's in virtually every scene of the movie. Like, it was incredible, his performance. I would completely agree with you. He has made some bad movies the last decade. No question. He's had some stinkers. Dirty Grandpa, obviously, notably, you know, Rocky and Bullwinkle. Has he mailed it in? 100%. But is he still capable of greatness? Yes. And Killers of the Flower Moon will be part of that. And The Irishman was that. Silver Linings Playbook, great film, 2011.
I'm doing my Robert De Niro right now impression, just my face. Like, it doesn't sound like him, but see the face?
I wish people could see Chris's face right now.
Robert De Niro, that's the face.
We'll get to Nick Davis here in just a second, but as I said off the top, I lament the fact we missed the great comedies of the past. When I think of August, I think of the summer, great comedies, right? The Hangover, Ghostbusters, you name it. So you know what? Let's give it a little love to There's Something About Mary, which I think is one of the great comedies of the last 25 years. Came out back in the late 90s, stars Ben Stiller, you got Cameron Diaz. These guys were on the cusp, Chris, of becoming superstars, you know, and Matt Dillon's really funny. I think what works about There's Something About Mary is it's got the crassness, it's got the vulgarity. I mean, for God's sakes, the movie was known for the fact they use semen as hair gel, and the fact there's a close-up of one of Ben Stiller's testicles. We got a bleeder! It has that stuff, but it actually has some real genuine sweetness. There is actually a nice romance here in this movie. Everyone does fall in love with Cameron Diaz. She's so beautiful and so charming and so seductive and seems like the girl next door that, of course, all these guys would be crazy about her. And the Farrelly brothers, this was apex for them. Peter Farrelly later, of course, won an Academy Award working with Green Book, but like this was like Farrelly brothers comedy where, again, crass, vulgar, but actually sweet. You've got a sing-along here. Like the fact there's a band throughout the movie, they would always use people who had special needs but showed the fact that they could be malicious and bad, and the fact that the guy with the bad legs is like the crippled guy is clearly a horrible person. He's using his disability for nefarious reasons. The fact Cameron Diaz's brother, he's got mental issues, and the fact that they don't make fun of him, like he's just there. Has anyone seen my baseball? Has anyone seen my wiener? I mean, there's so much that's wrong with Something About Mary, and yet so much of it works. I think it's a genuinely charming, funny movie, and we haven't even talked about Brett Favre.
That is what I think of. You say to me, what do you think of Something About Mary? I think of semen in the hair, Ben Stiller zipping up his balls, and Brett Favre acting terribly. Like, that is what I think of when I think of Something About Mary. And I think it's interesting that that's a rare movie where they play, you mentioned it, the band playing like the intro music, but you see them playing it. I've always been intrigued by that. I don't know why movies don't use that more.
Yeah.
I just like that.
I agree. It was very unique. And I love Matt Dillon. I mean, the fact he's got that pencil mustache and those teeth, the hat, like this guy is just a brutal, slimy, scummy
and
guy.
And that guy, I forget his name, the actor, the guy who's very intimidated by Mary. Yes, that guy. I love that guy in the movie.
Chris Sellers, a Woogie, whatever the hell his name is. I mean, he's got all the zits and stuff coming. I'm like, oh my God, he is just an absolute disaster. But you're right. Great comic energy from Chris Elliott.
Both of these movies, because we're about to do Superbad as well, a lot of good performances in these movies.
Yeah. Let's do a couple minutes on Superbad. Again, you're a bigger fan than I. I like it a lot. But the fact you said it's one of your all-time favorites, what I love about it is McLovin. I just think McLovin is such, again, an endearing, unique, original character, along with the fact, of course, this is Fat Jonah Hill when he was really genuinely funny. You know, Judd Apatow production, the fact that these guys were really kind of hitting the whole idea of adolescence comedies and the drugs and the boozing, all that's there. But McLovin, to me, is what sets the movie apart.
I don't know. Michael Cera. Cera's amazing. In that movie. I love the buddy cop, Bill Hader, Seth Rogen. I mean, like I said, Emma Stone, is this her coming out party, Emma Stone?
I think
Stone?
So, yeah.
I'm pretty sure, like I said, there's a lot. Joe Latruglio, what's this? Do you know this guy, this actor? He's the creepy guy who's like, you guys on MySpace or what? Like the guy with the, I'm telling I'm telling you, there's so many one-liners in this movie too. Jonah Hill, I'll just go fuck myself. Like, people don't forget with the guy with the kid. Like, I'm telling you, I could just go on for days just spitting out random lines. I love it.
And I think it's underrated in some ways, right? Like, I think most people.
It's not even a first name. It just says McLovin. I'm sorry. I just keep going.
In terms of great quotable comedies, it's got to be like top 10, right? It's amazing.
And Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg wrote that when they were like teenagers. Yes. Like, everything in the movie, there's like a scene where someone's dancing with a woman and you get period blood on the pants. That apparently really happened to a friend of Seth Rogen when he was growing up.
Oh.
So, I mean, like, a lot of this stuff is, like, real stuff that happened to them. Just a classic, man. Anytime Superbad's on, I watch it.
Great comedies. There's Something About Mary, Superbad. If you haven't seen them, check them out.
All right, Adnan, this is a weird one. There's a movie being made with Will Smith's production company, The Chainsmokers, which have a production company, I'm learning. I mean, this is... And NASCAR. Yeah. I mean, did we just pick three random things from the world and we're like, let's put these three things together and have them make a movie together?
Yeah, this sounds like Kill, Marry, Fuck, right? It's one of these like random games. Like, all right, let's put three things together. Okay, Will Smith, Chainsmokers, movie. NASCAR. Makes absolutely zero sense.
That's actually not a terrible idea to like just have random movie ideas. Like, you want original movies? Just take three random things from pop culture and throw them together and make a movie.
This story is ridiculous. The film following Lila, an ambitious sports agent, loses her superstar client for the start of the NASCAR season, decides to take a chance on a rebellious female dirt track star, 17-year-old Piper Kite. With her career on the line, Lila's challenge is only one if she can also reform Piper's reclusive father. I'm assuming this is Will Smith. No, it's not actually. Matthew Kite, a former NASCAR champion who walked away from the sport, hasn't been seen in 4 years. If he was the recluse, Chris, I'm in. But no, he's only a producer. No plans to star on the film. He just wants to be part of the sizzle reel. Like, who wants to see a bunch of good old boys, bunch of rednecks from North Carolina with some electronic synth music from the Chainsmokers?
You kind of reached the point where if Will Smith's in your movie, it's not that good of a movie. So him being a producer may be the play here. But, I'm intrigued by this. It's not a terrible premise for a movie. I'm just still blown away by why the Chainsmokers are here. Like, I know that they have some connection to NASCAR. I've read that they've performed at a bunch of races, but I'm just confused here. But like I said, I'm digging it.
Chainsmokers, right? You hear them all, right, pop hits, you hear them all today, electronic music, whatever. I'm like, yeah, like they're not bad. I'm with you. I wouldn't think the Chainsmokers, if you see the music of the Chainsmokers, okay, sure. The fact they have a production company, a little surprising. Yeah. Oh, I like the title, Kick the Habit Productions.
There's another movie coming out. It's involving Pop-Tarts, Justin Bieber, and Robert De Niro, oddly enough. It's a weird one. That's not true.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, it's a real pleasure to bring in Nick Davis. He is as prolific as it comes, a producer, writer, and director. He's got a tremendous documentary about the New York Mets, which is coming 30 for 30, two parts, September 14th, September 15th on ESPN. And he's got a great book called Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, a dual portrait. How about this coincidence coming out on September 14th? Author, writer, director. Nick, you're quite busy. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you, Adnan. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Let's dive into the Mets. I love the documentary. And this analogy isn't going to fit, but go with me. Whenever I watch the 86 Mets stuff, I think of the movie Platoon. Because what happens is I think about Willem Dafoe as one leader, and I think of Tom Berenger as another leader. And Gary Carter is the one leader, you know, devout Christian, saint-like, energetic, rubs some of the guys the wrong way, a little bit, you know, as Keith Hernandez said, loves the curtain calls, camera Carter. Now, it doesn't quite work, because, of course, Willem Dafoe smokes dope, and Gary Carter wouldn't do that, but work with me. And then Tom Berenger, right, evil, dark, intense, does drugs. Okay, Keith Hernandez did cocaine in the past, definitely intense, you know, dark side.
Love it. Like, so, love it.
I don't know if that totally works, but when I'm watching it, I kept thinking to myself, what a great companion piece. 86 Mets and Platoon came out in 1986. Let's start with the leadership of Carter and Hernandez, which was so critical to that team.
Well, that's fantastic. I had never considered that, but that's terrific. And we did interview Oliver Stone for the film because he came back from Platoon into New York City in the summer of 86, and he saw what was going on, and he wrote Wall Street and wrote the immortal line, greed is good, which sort of exemplified that era. Yeah, it's terrific. I think the leadership of that team at the time there was this sort of yin and yang. There was Hernandez, the dark leader, and you know, I've often thought of them as the sort of Lennon and McCartney of the team. But I love the platoon thing, especially because Defoe, sadly, or his character, died. Carter's the only one, ironically, of the 86 Mets who is not with us anymore, and he was obviously the you know, lived the cleanest life of any of them. But I think that they were sort of two poles, you know, the good, optimistic, cheerful, go get them, rah rah of Carter, and then the dark, intelligent, cerebral intensity of Hernandez. And they needed both to make it work, I think.
Yeah, I love the fact that even though Keith is clearly annoyed by him, that they were like, you know, oil and water, the fact he was like, oh, Carter loved the curtain calls, but he goes, listen, Gary was always icing his knees an hour before. I love the fact that's a great story. In the 86, obviously the World Series, Game 6, after Carter got scored the run, immediately started putting the knee pads on, like, buckle up, let's go to work. Like, his intensity was there. Dykstra tells a great story when he woke up Gary in his hotel room, and Carter was clearly not pleased by that. So even though he has a huge heart and was a wonderful guy, he was a competitor. He wanted to win as much as anybody. The best story about
He was very tough.
Yes.
He was a super tough guy. He was not sort of milquetoast, you know, Pollyanna-ish, just totally happy. Right. He was very, very intense, and it bothered him that he'd never won in Montreal, and he came to the Mets, and as Keith says, all he really wanted to do was win.
Yeah, the best story of the two of those guys together in terms of, like, leadership, I don't know how you got the B-roll, it may have just been random, but Keith is telling the story, I think, that Carter was giving the pitcher a pep talk, walks away, and Keith goes, yeah, fuck all that, just throw the fastball.
Exactly. No, it's amazing, and the announcer, Joe Garagiola, comes on and says, you know, Carter working Hernandez like a symphony orchestra. And Sid then comes on and says, for me, it was Keith.
Right.
He listened to Keith. They all really listened to Keith. Carter was like the leader sort of for the public.
Right.
But I think internally it was much more Hernandez. And then, as Bobby Ojeda points out, Ray Knight.
Yeah.
Ray Knight was the glue that really held that team together.
A great story is that Game 6, of course, no one forgets now because the World Series is so epic, but that NLCS, 16-inning game, and the fact that Keith Hernandez told Jesse Orosco, if you throw a fastball, we're going to fight. Like I'm going to kick your ass right in the mouth.
Yeah.
Ended up being three great sliders. They won that game. But honestly, Nick, Mike Scott was like Jaws, right? I remember that it was like, they cannot face Mike Scott again. He is scuffing the crap out of this ball. If they lose this game, they're going to get shut out in Game 7. That's why that game had such drama to it, because they didn't want to face Mike Scott.
Yeah, it was such intensity because, you know, to a man, they told me, like, they couldn't hit him. They couldn't beat him. And I think as fans at the time, we were like, yeah, we'll figure out a way. But they felt like we can't get this guy. And so I think for them, it was, you know, such intensity as inning went by. You know, it was like, we have to win this game.
Why wouldn't MLB take it seriously? Because they said they had literally proof of scuffed baseballs. Like, that's amazing to me. They actually had proof. And yet Peter Uberoff was turning a blind eye. Everyone knew he was cheating.
Yeah, everyone did know he was cheating. But I think they just felt like, look, you know, what are they going to do? Replay game four? Like, they didn't get the balls to the league office until the next day.
Oh, okay.
And it was sort of like, you know, what are you going to do?
Right.
He says he doesn't do it. We don't have video proof. And, you know.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. Once again, we're talking to Nick Davis, the new documentary, 30 for 30 in the Mets, executive produced by Jimmy Kimmel, September 14th, 15th. I love Dwight Gooden. When I see him, I have so many different emotions. I think, God, he was incredible in 84, 85. I think of sadness and tragedy and all the stuff he's been through and the drugs. I also am proud of him because the fact he did come back, he won 193 ball games. He's still kicking, as you said. It's not like drug addiction has caught him yet. He's a survivor, as is Daryl Strawberry. But I tell you, that story that he said, you know, when they won, he said it was the best day and the worst day of my life in a four-hour span. We went from winning the World Series to me calling my drug dealer, and he's in Long Island thinking he's with a bunch of friends high as a kite, and he missed the parade. I mean, that is such a sobering account of one of the great stars in the sport.
Yeah, if you think about the power of addiction, what that must be like to be so far gone that you're sitting in a crack house watching on TV, your teammates celebrating without you. And he says, that's when I sobered up and I realized, like, I blew it. Like, you can't go back. You can't do it again. The parade's over. And yeah, it's heartbreaking. And he's so open about it. It's really terrific and very, very relatable, I think. He's a tremendous guy.
I did not know that story. Ray Knight told about Peter Uberoth telling him, hey, listen, you've got a young black superstar on your team who's got a serious drug problem. And then he went to Daryl, and Daryl goes, no, it's Doc. And Daryl denied it. So no, I never said that. I just said, it's not me. And hello, deductive reasoning. If it's not me, it's obviously Doc.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, what's crazy is that why Ubaroth is playing this kind of coy game. Like, I'm not going to tell you who it is, right. But it's one of two guys. It's like, why don't you just tell him, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, so, yeah, it's tremendous to get to know these guys and find out what was really going on behind the scenes.
Back to Keith, the family dynamic was amazing. His dad clearly loved him, hard charging, but nothing was ever good enough. 11-time Gold Glover, 5-time All-Star, MVP. And there was months Keith wouldn't talk to him. I got emotional when Keith told the story about his brother being there. And it was it was really sweet the way he was like, you know, my brother was there for me. And Gary was like, come on, man, let's go. Like he almost like he felt that inspiration from his brother. He felt like he got that hit in that game against the Astros because of his brother. And it's kind of sad the relationship with his dad. It's like his dad really loved him, was genuine. But as Keith kind of gives that shrug, like, you know, he died before we had a chance to really reconcile properly. That was tough.
Yeah, yeah, it's a tough relationship. It's a complex relationship. And I think, you know, Keith brings up Fear Strikes Out. Like, yeah. You know, that was the model for him was this domineering father who clearly loved him. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, if you listened to me, you would hit 325 rather than 311. You know, it's like, come on, Dad. Like, I won MVP. I'm a, you know, whatever it is, 11-time All-Star. Like, right. Gold Glove, give me a break, right. You know. And then, as you say, like, sadly, you know, the year Keith retired, his dad got cancer and passed away, and they never got a chance to kind of just be guys together. It was always all about Keith's career.
Lonnie Dykstra is quite a beautiful mess, isn't he? I mean, at one point he has a line, I'll walk around the 15-inch cock. I mean, he's clearly mumbling at some point. I don't know if it's you're the one telling him. He's talking about famous explorers, and you say, Columbus? He's like, yeah, that guy. Did you have any sort of hesitation, like as a producer, director, you're like, all right, how much do I use of Lenny? Because it is entertaining, and he is notable. He's very important to the team. And how much of it are people going to be laughing at Lenny Dykstra and what's become of him?
Oh, I don't think they're going to laugh at him. I think they're going to laugh with him. Yeah. I think Lenny Dykstra is crazy like a fox. Right. I feel like he plays the role of wild man to a T. He knows what he's doing, and he was very honest about his struggles. And I think at the end of the film, in the fourth part, he says, like, you know, his life has not turned out the way he might have wanted. But at the end of the day, like, he gets to say he won a World Series in New York City. And that's something not a lot of people get to say. I think Lenny is amazing. I think people are going to, I mean, he's tremendously entertaining.
Yes.
And is, you know, you can't turn him off. To me, he began the interview with 5 minutes of completely unprintable stuff that we could never have used. But I've rarely laughed so hard. And I felt like, oh, my God, this guy is Lenny Bruce. And by the end, I felt like he was Marlon Brando in All the Waters, like lamenting what could have been.
I love those references.
Kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, could have been a contender. Let's get to game six. Amazing stuff here. You got Howard Bryant saying you knew it was going to be an epic collapse once the run scored. Bud Harrelson, the third baseman, say he's known for bouncing it when it came to Stanley.
Yeah.
The fact that Ray Knight said, I didn't bend my knees. I thought I would hurt my lower back. I did, but there was such elation. Yeah. 16 separate pitches could have ended the World Series. I love the video just because of movie guy. That movie, Mookie Steady came after the hit. That was like...
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, it's a handheld shot. A guy, and no one's ever seen that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they've seen little bits of it, but like picking him up at the mound, Mookie, for some reason, rounded first, ran on to second after the ball goes into right field. Like, game's over. I don't know what. And he said, like, I don't know what I was doing, but he just ran over. The cameraman ran out and just followed him all the way, this long shot from the mound into the dugout and then down the dugout steps into the club, down the tunnel towards the clubhouse. It's a beautiful shot and a great moment, like, to be with Mookie Wilson. You see the policeman clapping him on the back and stuff. It's like New York, the essence of 1986.
Yeah, I was thinking, I've never seen that before, so I'm glad you pointed that out. It's never before seen. If you're a Mets, this documentary is worth it just for that shot alone after one of the great moments ever in baseball history. Mookie, the way the camera falls him was great. The funniest is Bud Bill Burr, the comedian, the Red Sox fan, is incredible. His two quotes after the Kevin Mitchell hit, for fuck's sakes, pull him. And when Bob Stanley came out, he goes, he's got no shoulders. Looks like a fucking beanbag. That's our closer. Yeah. How great was Bill Burr?
Bill Burr was amazing. And that is one of the joys of having Jimmy Kimmel as your executive producer, because you're like, hey, Bill Burr is a huge Red Sox fan. Hey, Jimmy, do you happen to? He's like, yeah, you know. And the next thing you know, I'm talking to Bill Burr remotely from this office when he's in LA. But it was an amazing interview. He made me laugh really well.
You mentioned, as far as celebrities, you got Oliver Stone. You also have George R.R. Martin, a Game of Thrones. How did you get him?
Well, he's a huge Mets fan, and I think that there's a certain kind of Mets fan. He actually said a great bite that we weren't able to use. He said, for my sins, I am a Mets fan. There's a certain kind of Mets fan who, like, they'll do anything if the Mets are involved. So like he jumped, he was like, yeah, I'd love to do it. And, you know, we sent a, you know, a one man band, you know, cameraman guy out to, you know, his hideaway in the mountains someplace. We're not supposed to know where he is, George R. R. Martin. He's such a hideaway. Right. But yeah, we had terrific, terrific celebrities who wanted to do this. John McEnroe, Mike Tyson, yeah. Cyndi Lauper, really fun group of people, in addition, of course, to the players and then writers who were talking us through that time.
And what you do an amazing job of really is not just focusing on the Mets and getting all the baseball stuff right, but New York at that time, a time of excess, the drugs, the partying, why that team is so likable. This is a team of a bunch of cads, Nick, and yet people love them. They found them so endearing.
Well, I think that what it was that team captured that time and place so perfectly. You don't ordinarily think of a sports team merging with its city and its time quite as perfectly as those guys captured the mid-80s in New York City. And, you know, it didn't last long. It, you know, the next fall, Terry Pendleton hits the back-breaking home run, and 3 weeks later, the stock market crashes, and that's it for the go-go 80s and the dynasty that never was. It was like they lived fast. And, you know, a lot of people are like, God, wasn't it so disappointing that they didn't have more of a dynasty and didn't win more than once? To me, once you spend time with these guys and find out what it was really like, it's a miracle that they won one.
The image of Lenny Dykstra, tobacco juice dripping down. I love Jeff Proman, by the way. Proman's one of the all-time greats. His book is great. He's got such great stories.
His book is great.
He's got great stories in there as well. Once again, you can catch the Mets documentary September 14th and 15th. It's to be on ESPN. The book, Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, A Dual Portrait by Nick Davis, is coming out September 14th. It is fantastic. Let's dive in first to Herman, who, if you want a little, I mean, he would have fit in well with the 86 Mets, I think, with his sense of humor. How about this? When he was in Pennsylvania working with the miners, he had one of his favorite dirty jokes. A young girl walking down the street approached by a man who tells her, "You have a hair on your lollipop." "I should have," the girl replies. "I'm 15 years old." Later on, there's a story involving Joe in which he's trying to get married. And, you know, he's trying to get advice here from Herman. And Herman says to him, because this is dealing with like simple anti-Semitism, Herman advised Joe to tell his mother-in-law to be that he'd happily reattach his foreskin if that would help ease her conscience on the matter. This is a guy who, despite his peccadilloes, was beloved in Hollywood. When he won the Oscar for Citizen Kane, people were like, "Mank, Mank." Why do you think he was such a lovable guy, despite the fact he was awfully crass?
Well, I think Herman was my grandfather.
Right.
And so I, of course, love him, even though he died 12 years before I was born. But I grew up knowing about this just lovable, warm-hearted, big-hearted mess of a guy. Sloppy, self-destructive, right. didn't respect the work that he was doing and that he was so good at.
Right.
But felt like he was doing it with one arm tied behind his back because his real work was something else. What that something else was, we'll never know. But, you know, a lot of the early screenwriters in Hollywood felt that way. They felt like movies are a bastard art form and we should be writing novels or doing plays or let's get back to the East Coast where the action is. And I don't know what made him so lovable, except that I think he had a tremendous heart and a tremendous soul. And then his brother, 11 and a half years younger, Joe, was a different story.
Yeah, and that's the perfect way to get into Joe, because this is a guy who, again, I know about the great films, multi-Academy Award winner, but how about this story? In the mid-1960s, watching his son Tom navigate through Hollywood's social world as a young man, Joe gave him a piece of paternal advice on dating actresses. The crassness of this counsel would echo through the decades and contribute to Joe's poor reputation in my own nuclear family. "Never fuck a starlet," Joe told Tom, "when you can fuck a star." How was he viewed within your family?
Well, I mean, that's how he was viewed. He was viewed as like, this is a really ambitious guy. He's really cold and kind of nasty. And, you know, when I grew up, I never saw him. We never had anything to do with him. And then when I finally met him as a young adult, I was like, this guy's fine. You know, he was at that point, he was 80 and he mellowed. His third wife was wonderful. And he had a very happy, you know, final 20 years of his domestic life. Mm-hmm. Professionally, no. But I thought, God, this guy's such a mensch. And then I started hearing all these stories. And you start to wonder, like, where did this all come from? And what was he like as a kid? And that's what I hope, you know, the book investigates is like, was he always such a monster? I mean, there's another story in the book where one of his sons is told by Joe's sister, like, it's so sad what happened to your dad because he became such a monster. And he thought, what do you mean he became such a monster? Was there a time when he wasn't a monster? So, you know, it's a complicated legacy, to be sure.
And speaking of complicated, that's a perfect description of Herman. And, of course, everyone loves the movie Mank, David Fincher's film, which gets to the heart of Citizen Kane and the fact that Herman Mankiewicz didn't get nearly enough love and recognition for it. Listen, he was a drunkard. We all get that. The gambling was an issue. But he also, I love the fact you pointed his contributions to film. Wizard of Oz, he had that idea to go from black and white to color, which, along with Rosebud, as you point out, those are like two of the great inventions ever in movies. And how about this line about Orson Welles? People forget what a colossally handsome man the young Orson Welles was, but Sarah never did. And to read her interview transcripts about the neck massages Welles gave her while she reclined on Herman's hospital bed is to go to a place no grandson should ever go.
I gotta say, you're picking out some very interesting moments. I do remember, I was reading the transcript, I felt myself blushing. I was like, Goma, what are you doing? Stop. You know, and this, you know, this was 30 years later, and she's telling a story in the 70s to an interviewer, and I just read the transcript. I don't want to read about this. And there was another story that she told about, like, walking in on Herman and a secretary, where this was never put in any other book, and I was just like, I have to use this, but this is horrible. It was pretty complicated, guys, both of them.
But I love the fact you point out, like, why is it so important to people how much of the credit he gets? But, of course, it is important to all of us. Like, he deserves more credit, and he knew the deal going in. Orson Welles did have an enormous ego, and, of course, he wanted to have – he was like an auteur before we had the auteur theory, right? He wanted to be everything known with Citizen Kane, and yet Mank was the guy that said, listen, I came up with the story. I came up with the structure. I knew all this stuff about Hearst. All my journalism background I poured into this. I wrote 99% of the dialogue, or 98% of it, and he had this great line. If he'd attended the Oscars, he would have said, I am very happy to accept this award in Mr. Welles' absence because the script is written in Mr. Welles' absence.
Yes. Yeah. No, Herman, I mean, it's interesting because he did. He made the deal. Like, everybody who worked for Welles knew it was a one-man band and that he got all the credit and this is going to be his premier movie and everybody knows. But Herman made a lot of noise and Welles finally turned around and I think kind of brilliantly thought, okay, not only am I going to give you credit, I'll put your name first.
Right.
You know, and I'll look magnanimous and history will show that I gave credit to this writer. You know, not nearly enough credit, according to my grandmother, but, you know, credit.
Yeah, and for Joe, his greatest achievement, All About Eve. And as you point out, hey, that was really what Joe loved, which is the theater. So he can have this great love letter to the theater, but also a savage indictment of cinema. I mean, Bette Davis is unbelievable. This is the part that I was stunned by, because I did not realize this. What makes it improbable, of course, is that Addison, that's a character, I think, played by George Sanders. Yeah, he's an if-it dandy, as queer as the day is long, no more sexually attracted to Eve than he is to that boy Weevil. It's curiously remarkable that it took a man as flamingly devoted to his own heterosexuality as Joe Mankiewicz to create two such iconic gay characters, closeted though Addison and Eve may be. Indeed, Eve is an almost passionately asexual figure, enthralled not to sex or romance, but to power and ambition. Still, can anyone doubt that if the film were made today, we'd get more than just the whiff Joe gives us of Eve's lesbianism? I did not get that from watching All But Eve. So credit to you that you were able to, listen, you know the film, it's your family, et cetera. I was impressed you were able to find that stuff.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Every time I've watched All But Eve, I'm like, this is clearly what's going on. I mean, and the other thing that's going on, I think, is it's Joe's emotional autobiography.
Right.
Here is a story of a larger than life, wonderful, beloved, older artist, Margot Channing, Bette Davis, and then the younger, colder, usurper ambition of Eve Harrington. And Eve takes down Margot, much as I think Joe subconsciously thought he was taking Herman down. Of course, Joe denied this. It's not an original theory to me, but he said, no, it's got nothing to do with Herman. You know, I had nothing to do with, you know, Herman had nothing to do with the movie. It's odd that someone as devoted to psychoanalysis as Joe was completely refused to examine his own motivations for writing this beautiful, brilliant script.
Yeah, it's one of the all-time great scripts, and it's certainly still a brilliant movie all about Eve. The book is fantastic. It's called Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, a dual portrait by Nick Davis. I'll close with this, because after I read this section, every single person is going to want to buy this book. Tom Mankiewicz, Joe's and Rose's second son, loved to tell a gloriously awkward story about the time he was at a Hollywood party in the early 1960s and came across Oskar Werner, the acclaimed Austrian actor. At the party, Werner was drunk, and he took exception to someone calling him German. According to Tom, Werner snapped at this guy, "I'm not German, I'm Austrian." There was a big silence, and me being a big kissy-faced 23-year-old kid, I said, "You have to understand, to call an Austrian a German is a little bit like calling an Irishman an Englishman. They don't appreciate it." Oskar Werner was delighted and asked Tom how he knew so much about Austrian resentments. Tom said that his mother had been Austrian, an actress, in fact. Werner asked her name, and when Tom told him, Werner's eyes lit up. The Joseph Stad Theater, 1935. Tom nodded proudly. Werner smiled thoughtfully, then said, "When I first masturbated, it was to a picture of your mother." The room went silent. Tom stared at the man. "If you live 50 lives, no one is ever going to tell you that. The only thing I could say," he told me 40 years later, "was thank you."
Yeah, that, and Tom loved that story, and it was gloriously awkward.
Oh, it's so good. Competing with Idiots, Herman and Joe Mankiewicz, a dual portrait. Buy the book September 14th, and make sure you watch this outstanding documentary on the Met September 14th and 15th. Nick Davis, can't thank
Once
you enough.
Once upon a time in Queens. Yes. Thank you so much, Adnan. It was great being here.
All right. Great stuff, man. That was awesome.
Wow, thank you. That was super.
Yeah, it was. It's always a big difference. Someone was joking to me, when you actually read the book, the guest is thrilled. I'm like, "Well, yeah, of course. You send me the book, I'm going to read it."
But you were also picking such really great, personal, weird things.
Adnan, authors love you. What's up with this? You just have this connection with authors, man. I mean, geez.
We're talking 6 authors in 3 months, and every single guy loves me.
I'm telling you, I just realized what the perfect recipe is if you ever meet an author. Read their book. They love it. I mean...
That's actually an unbelievable point. Like, how low a bar are we setting here? Like, most of these author interviews, 2% of people are actually reading the book. So I actually do the work of reading the book.
Except Mark Harris.
And they're like putty
not
in my
impressed.
Hands. Dude, that guy's awesome. Except for Mark Harris. Mark Harris kind of like, your description of Mark Harris is amazing. I was like, this book is so good. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Dustin Hoffman. He's like, yeah, I know.
Something
like,
I don't awesome. Know.
What's nice?
I'm amazing. I know.
Yeah, like, I know I crush.
But everyone else, man, you read that book and they're like, that was amazing. Thank you.
Who knows? Maybe next time we'll have another author here on Cinephile. Thanks so much to Nick Davis, though. He was awesome. And thanks so much to all of you. Thanks to Chris Cody. By the way, Cody going off to another vacation, another family vacation. Yeah. Once you have a kid, this is what happens when you're off to Disney. How fired up are you for Disney?
I'm more fired up about Disney than I was about SeaWorld. I'm still feeling like my life, I just have no control over my life anymore. And my life is just like, I feel like an asshole now. Like, I love my kid. She's excited about Disney. But... you know, I'm going to need a beach at some point. Like, the next vacation, yeah. I already told my wife, is mine. I'm picking the next vacation after this.
You do start to wonder, like, hey, when do I get one for me? Because it's always with the kids. Like, hey, do I get one of these? Like, you had your whole life, Chris. You had 30-plus years. Yeah. Now it's all about your little girl. It's going to be a blast, though. You, your mom, your dad, it's going to be great. Cinephile next week. We'll be coming to you, as always, next Thursday. Even though Chris is taking vacation, he's not missing an episode. Mm-hmm. The new film called Worth It stars 2 of my favorite actors, Michael Keaton, Stanley Tucci. That's coming on Netflix. And also old movies. How about Out of Africa? Claire Atkins went to Africa. I saw it was on TCM, Turner Classic Movies, 1985 Best Picture. Winner Robert Redford, Meryl Streep will knock that as well. Plus, the wild card. Find out what that'll be.
Stay
next
tuned.
Time.
You don't know what it is because it's a wild card. It wouldn't be a wild card if you knew what it was. Stay tuned.
We'll see you at the movies.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.